I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. My guest today is Charlie Borman, the presenter and travel writer famed for his Let's Just Do It approach. It's a motto brought to life with his series of long-way epic road trips alongside best friend and collaborator, the actor Ewan McGregor. But it was a near-fatal crash for Charlie in 2016 that was to teach this dynamic duo the true meaning of friendship and to provide my guest today with his inspiring advice that if you say you're going to do something, then do it. You'll be much happier. Charlie, welcome to Changemakers.
Thank you very much. It's very kind.
It's a pleasure.
I was writing that comment down last night in a panic because I hadn't filled out the questions that you'd asked me to do. You made the sound very good, basically.
It's definitely got the seize the day idea there, hasn't it? Which I think in many respects sums up your image as a person of action, as a person that likes to get out there and do things and enjoys the spirit of adventure. Where do you think that comes from?
I think, well, that comment kind of comes a little bit from, you know, when I was younger, I was obsessed with skiing and off-piste skiing and all that kind of stuff. And whenever you were organizing a ski holiday with friends, you know, you would start off with 10 friends want to do it. And then by the time you go skiing, there's only two of you left because everyone says, yeah, I'm going to do it. And then they never do. And that used to really piss me off. And so I think that's sort of been in my head a little bit. And I think it's a bit like anything in life. If you really, really want something, you know, and the motivation is there, you'll do it, you know. So it's, you know, if you really want that car when you're a kid, you'll get out and you'll get a job and you'll get that 100 quid or 500 quid together to buy it.
If you're that person that sat there listening to this show today thinking, yeah, I'm the person that signs up to everything and never turns up on the day, what's your advice to them in terms of what's the trigger, what's the tipping point that kind of gets you going with the vim and vigor that you've clearly got?
Well, I don't know. I think if you sign up to everything and do nothing, eventually people are going to stop asking you to come along because they kind of know the question. It's a bit like when you go out with drinks with friends, you know, there's always that one friend who weighs all his options up and then decides to choose the best one and usually ends up doing nothing. I think you've always got to find, I think it takes time to be able to find the thing that really turns you on, you know, as a person. And I suppose I got very lucky and I found motorcycles really, really young. And so that's something that that always makes you, it's quite social. It makes you go out. You know, especially during lockdown and stuff like that, you could get out and there was a point when they said you could go out to your two friends or something on a motorbike because you were social distancing because you had your helmets on, you weren't very far away from each other. It's a great piece of meditation, really. You know, when if you've had a hard day at work or whatever, you jump on the bike and you ride home, you know, because there's no distractions like in a car where you have a telephone, you have a packet of crisps on the passenger seat or listening to the radio, or you inevitably end up on the telephone still working. And so by the time you rock up at home and you get out the car and you walk into the house and you open the door and your girlfriend or wife or kids meet you, you sort of go, shh, I'm on the phone, you know. And so there's been no break, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you jump on a motorbike or cycle home, by the time you get to the house, you're off the bike, you've forgotten about work and you walk in the house and it's a totally different experience.
But it strikes me, you are one of life's fidgets, Charlie. I mean, you love doing lots of things. I mean, you've only got to look at your Twitter feed to see everything from bikes to the big stand-up paddleboard adventure. And in preparation for this interview, I was flicking through Around the World in 80 Days, and Jules Verne wrote about Phileas Fogg. He said, it seemed just as if the typhoon were a part of his program. Do you see yourself as a living typhoon?
I don't know. I've never really seen myself as an adventurer or whatever. I just see myself as a guy who loves motorbikes who got lucky, you know. Mm. And I think when you have a passion, you look for every opportunity to do it. And I think, you know, Ewan and I, when we first met each other, I was an actor then, and we met on a film set together, and we both had a love of motorbikes and that's kind of sort of where our friendship started. And, you know, and I don't know, 25 years later, we're still talking about motorbikes. I mean, we text each other most days, you know, sending each other. There's a great website called Bring a Trailer. And you know, there's secondhand motorcycles and cars and stuff. And we're always firing over photos of bikes or shit that we'd like to buy, you know. But from that passion came the travel, and that released that kind of wanderlust that I think that a lot of people have in the film industry have, you know, because you're quite nomadic.
The nomadic adventure, yeah.
And you know, my father is a film director. I mean, he a guy called John Boorman, and he directed films like Point Blank and Helen Pacific and Deliverance, Excalibur.
No, he's had some big hits.
Yeah. I mean, some big old movies. And, you know, as children, we were always just thrown into them. He said, why employ children when I have four free ones? So that was always his philosophy.
Well, read you had some unattributed roles in things like Alien and others. But I think, obviously, I want to talk about the Long Way series in a moment. But just while you're on your dad, I mean, I read that you said that, you know, your career was mapped out because of that very sort of large father figure in terms of the acting world and that side of thing. Do you think that helped you in terms of the next steps, in terms of moving beyond acting and beyond that kind of world into something very, very different in terms of the travel side?
I think so. I mean, my father made movies all over the world, you know, from the South Pacific to South America, you know, South Carolina and the rivers. And his films were always really challenging movies, always difficult movies to make. You know, if you look at Excalibur or Deliverance, you know, where they shot the whole movie on a river in rapids, basically. And so I think he was always quite an adventurous person. And then when he wasn't making movies, we'd always travel with him as a whole family. So we'd all go off for a year somewhere. Then when he wasn't making movies, we were living in the mountains in Wicklow in Ireland. And so, you know, I had a motorbike from a very young age. I used to strap a spare petrol tank on the back of the bike, and I used to go off with my mate Kaz. We'd go off into the Wicklow mountains until the petrol ran out, and then we'd fill them up again, and then we'd ride home. And that was kind of, you know, we didn't really know where we'd go. Mum and Dad had no idea. Sometimes I would just end up back at Kaz's house and spend the night there. And, you know, but there was no phone calls. It was quite feral at the time. So I suppose because of Dad and the travel and stuff like that. And then I'm tremendously dyslexic as well. And so I really struggled in school. One of the outlets that really benefited me in school or that I really enjoyed in school was acting. I could do that. I suddenly realized it was where I've been able to sort of, where I could express myself. And then I left school at 16, quite young. I was making a movie in France, and then it kind of went from there. But then as the acting got more important, I've been more sort of successful at acting in the early 80s and 80s and 90s. I started to really struggle with to memorize dialogue, and I would get terribly stressed by that. And so slowly I kind of did less and less acting and more painting and decorating, which is an actor's second favorite job to do, or second most popular job to do for an actor. And so the acting came less, and the painting and decorating, and then eventually doing people's houses up became more. So there was like a 10-year period where I just wasn't really acting. I was just sort of sustaining myself with my wife and stuff. So that was quite a difficult period. And then occasionally I'd get a movie. And then one of those movies was The Serpent's Kiss, where I met Ewan.
Right. So is that where the Long Way idea came up? I mean, when did the, I mean, obviously we've just had the third Long Way Up, which is on Apple TV. Tell us about where the original inspiration came from. Because, you know, you questioned whether you were an adventurer, but I think anybody that's watched that series would say this is a proper adventurer in terms of just what you've done. I mean, you know, an outstanding series of adventures.
Well, I think Ewan and I were kind of slightly accidental travelers, you know, with that. I think both of us, from the moment we met, we loved motorbikes and we ran motorbike. We helped run a motorbike race team in the British Superbike series in British Superstock for 1,000cc bikes. And we came first and second in that championship with the team. So we had a success in that. And then we used to do track days together. We used to do weekends. We just used to with Roy and Paul and Richard, we used to, the five of us used to go off and do all sorts of things on bikes. And then I suppose from there we started looking, wanting a longer journey, a bigger journey. You know,
okay, so let me ask you this. When did it occur to you that meeting warlords with Kalashnikovs in Kazakhstan might be a really good thing to do?
Well, okay, so we decided to do it. We were just going to go down to south of Spain and meet our family down there, you know, and ride back. And then Ewan rang me up one day and he said, Charlie, got this great idea. He said, look, and so I went to his house for dinner and he had this big map of the world on the table. And he said, look, instead of going to Spain, why don't we go to China? Because my wife was brought up in China. And I thought, well, that's a good idea. And so we thought we'd do that. And then, you know, funny enough, both our wives said yes straight away. So I'm not sure if they just wanted to get rid of us.
I'm just imagining this moment where you say, Marbella's off.
Yeah, my bet's off. But China's on. You know,
China's like, on. Okay.
And then we really started to get into it. And we thought, this would be a brilliant idea. And we met this guy online who was Millennium Ride in 2000. And he'd done the Road of Bones. And we were just asking him questions about what it was like to travel. And he said, look, if you're going to go this way, you've got to do the Road of Bones in Far East Russia. So, and that's kind of been, then we thought, well, if we're going to do the Road of Bones, we'll just go over the Bering Straits. It can't be very far. and then we'll go on to New York. You know, and then I thought, well, I didn't have any money. And so I thought, how am I going to do this? And then someone said to us, why don't you write a book? Because, you know, two blokes off on an adventure, not knowing anything really, you know, would make a great book. Anyway, so we sort of did that, and that sounded interesting. Then Ewan, we got a kind of a book deal, and then Ewan and I thought, well, I can't, I'm dyslexic, I can't write. And then Ewan said, I'm not much better. And so, you know, we thought, how are we going to do this? And then we thought, what we'd do is we'd get little video cameras and we'd do video diaries, and then we'd get someone to help us, you know, construct the book, you know, which lots and lots of people do. And so we thought, brilliant idea. And then we thought, well, if we're going to do that, we may as well film it. And so it kind of snowballed. Well,
and there's a lovely style to that. I mean, it's very real in terms of, I mean, I want to touch on the friendship between you both. But before I do, I mean, there is also the fact that there's a common theme of jeopardy, I guess, in terms of will they make it, which I suppose in your latest...
Yes, we definitely felt that as well.
Well, I mean, it comes across, right? I mean, and in your latest series, Long Way Up, I mean, that's slightly brought to life by electric bikes that might not go any further than about 80 miles, I think, was the long distance target you had for them. There's always a sense of will they, won't they? But I suppose the thing, though, that everybody says that's watched them, that, you know, whether you are a motorbike enthusiast or a travel fan, it is the friendship between the pair of you, this sort of effusive love of life, this kind of chemistry that is so often commented on it and is so palpable between you. And I mean, tell us about that friendship and what it means to you.
I think, you know, you and I found each other with, you know, we both had a lot in common. We both had our first child, which had just been born when we were making this film on the west coast of Ireland, and we both have the love of motorcycles and stuff. So, and we, you know, both actors, and Ewan came up, you know, his uncle is a great actor, and so both of us have sort of milled around that kind of thing, and very different upbringings, but in many ways quite similar, and we just became friends, and I think maybe the reason, I don't really know why, I think there's a number of reasons why Long Ways became successful. One is because I think when we first did it, there was that wave of people wanting a bit more from their holiday than just sitting on a beach. So just at that time, sort of adventure holidaying was starting to get momentum. And then Ewan and I came along with this kind of adventure holiday type thing. And we kind of hit that wave of excitement, you know.
I'm loving that you're describing it as a holiday.
Oh, the adventure holiday. Well, Ewan and I,
But I mean, there is a kind of, you know, and you've used the word in the past, there's a love between the two of you. There's a real friendship. I mean, it's kind of like, it's kind of the sort of thing that I think we've all, you know, a lot of people will identify with that, where you find a kind of fellow traveler, you find a person. I mean, frankly, you know, I mean, I've got a great friend that I would see in very similar terms, but and I suppose it's often the things that aggravate you about each other as much as the things that you sort of like, you know, you like about each other. I mean, what would you describe as your various strengths and weaknesses as far as it comes to the friendship circle?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when we first went off on these trips, you know, people said, you know, you can be great friends, but when you go on this adventure, you know, it might not work, your relationship, and it might fall apart. And you hear lots of cases of people going off, friends are going off on these gap years or trips, whatever they're doing. A month into it or so, they've decided that they're going to go their own way, and it just doesn't work. And lucky enough for Ewan and I think it did. I mean, I think we're both different in character, but we have a similar respect and love for each other, and we have each other's back all the time. So even if he thinks I've made a wrong decision or whatever, he'll go with it, you know, and vice versa.
Is one of you the decision taker? I mean, does one of you say...
No, we're both...
Right.
No.
And left, turn, right.
We both sort of... Well, that's usually just getting lost. But I like to think I'm slightly better navigator than Ewan, but I think you'd probably say the same thing. But I used to always annoy Ewan because I used to be able to always pack up my tent and everything, you know, really quickly. So I'd pack up all my tent, and then you know, he'd be packing his up and he'd look round and I'd be sitting on my bike waiting to go, you know, that would always annoy him. And then on this long way up, you know, I don't know what happened, but I could never beat him to be ready to go. He was always there before.
He was always there. So, he'd learned his lesson.
You know, I think he just spent, you know, the 12 years, that the gap between the 12 years, just practicing.
Learning to pack, you know, more quickly. But I think the friendship.
I think it works, I suppose, in the TV show because it, often in people put two people together to make a TV show. And this was two people who wanted to do this thing together. And I think it came from a different angle. The great thing about these adventures is, you know, it's not just the A to B, but it's the people that you meet along the way that make it really, really interesting.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Randomness.
Because it strikes me that, look, there is an infectious friendship between the two of you. You clearly make each other laugh. That is a huge part of the show. But similarly, the people you meet along the way seem to, you know, restore your faith in goodness, in kindness, in the welcoming part of human nature. Because, you know, you turn up all over the world and somehow you manage to be liked. How did you do that?
Right. No, you know, we're there and we're doing this adventure that we were desperate to do. And you know, and it's so, people are so interesting. And as you travel along, you kind of need help sometimes, you know. And by realizing that, you know, a lot of people think, well, you know, you say to people, we're going to Africa or we're going to wherever, and people go, oh, that's a dangerous place. And you go, is it? And they go, oh, yeah, terribly dangerous. Have you been there? No. Yeah. And so, you know, people just assume if something happens, let's say in the continent of Africa, like something happens in I don't know, some incident happens in Nairobi, and then people go, well, that's Africa.
Yeah.
You know, and that takes in, you know, that takes in Northern Africa, Central Africa, Southern Africa. I mean, it's a very, very big continent, you know, and North Africa is extremely different to South Africa. I mean, they couldn't be any more different, you know, and then. So I think it's sort of the fear of the unknown that we all are. But when you start to realize and you travel around and you meet people, like, for instance, when we were on the long way up, we were looking for a charge in the middle of the day and we kind of messed up with it. We just needed a couple of hours to get to where we wanted to go. So we stopped off at this. It was quite a touristy town for the first time in quite a long time that we'd been kind of in a built up sort of area. And we thought we'd tried to get into this really nice posh restaurant. We thought we'd plug in, have a really nice meal, you know, treat ourselves. Anyway, we kept plunging the restaurant into darkness. And then,
but the bikes were sucking
the power. But not that they take much power, really, but listen, we'll try around the other side of the building. And we tried around the other side of the building, and then we plunged the whole kitchen into darkness, and the ovens went off. And at that point, they said, well, maybe not. And anyway, we ended up in this campsite. There's always power in campsites. And so we plugged into this campsite, and we met this couple, this one guy from Eastern Europe and one guy from Munga and his girlfriend from Turkey, and we got chatting to them and we listened to their story. He was in Northern Turkey somewhere, had stumbled in this town, met this girl, she's a teacher, and they kind of fell in love with each other, but he had to move on. So he moved on into Istanbul and she couldn't take him and he couldn't take, so he kind of went back for it. And then she told her father, who's quite traditional family, you know, quite strict traditional family in Turkey, as you can imagine. And she said, look, I've got this teaching job in Istanbul. And we were talking to her in South America and in Argentina. And I said, so does your father know where you are? And she goes, no. And he thinks that she's still in Istanbul. And I said, well, they'll probably know now. But what I loved was that these two people were clearly massively in love with each other. You could see it. And that she, you know, despite her upbringing, her quite conservative upbringing, you know, she... quite right, like everybody should do, is go in and live your dream and live your life. You know, as long as you're not hurting other people too much, you've got to live your life.
Yeah.
And there, these two people were living their life. Because we plunged the restaurant into darkness, we luckily ended up in this campsite, met these people, sat and had lunch with them. We bought them lunch and we just had a nice time. It's
well,
it's
I think
show.
That's a great vignette of, I think, the all three of the series, in the sense of that a big part of this is the fascination that you have in other people's lives and their stories, and it comes through in terms of, I guess, that circular energy that you get. Now, one of the things people assume, you know, that there's this sort of powerful bond between you and Ewan, which I'm sure there is. But one of the things you both talked about is that friendship had slightly drifted because of not being even on the same continent. And then in 2016, a lot changed. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, you know, after Long Way Down, Ewan kind of moved over to LA, and, you know, he became this, you know, was already this amazing A-star actor and stuff. And so he kind of moved over there, loves it over in the States, and I was over here. And then funny enough, in the first 3 years of living in LA, he spent most of his time in Europe making movies. And so whenever he came over here to make a movie, I was always off somewhere else. We just kept missing each other. And as you say, we just sort of drifted along together. And then in 2016, I was doing some work for Triumph, launching their new Tiger 1200, that kind of adventure bike. And I was taking a bunch of journalists out in Portugal. And I was overtaking a car, and the car decided to turn left. And then I got clipped by the car. Quite a bad crash. And then luckily, just after I clipped the car, I hit a wall with my legs and really messed them up. And it's quite funny, when you ride motorbikes, you know, you fall off the bike, your first thing to do is jump up, pick up the bike, get back on the bike, and pretend that nothing's happened. You know, so I tried to jump up on thing, and I looked, and I couldn't walk on my left leg. And I looked down, and there, just the bottom half of my leg was just sort of flopping around in all the wrong directions, and blood sort of pouring out everywhere. And so I kind of sat back down, but oh, this is not good.
And a near-death experience.
Well, yeah, I mean, that one was 2016, so I broke both legs quite badly, and I dislocated and broke my right ankle and destroyed my left tibia and fibula, and I had one of those cages around my leg, and then I broke my hand as well. And I remember sort of waking up the next morning in the hospital, you know, having had all these operations. I had, I think, an 11-hour operation and almost lost the leg and all this kind of, and I woke up and I looked down, and I could see both my legs were in bandages, my hand was in bandage, and I'm thinking, God, this is not good, you know, this is really bad. And then I noticed there was someone else in the room, and I looked over, and there was another guy in another bed in the same room, and he was in a much worse state than I was. And anyway, looking over him, and I looked down at myself and my two broken legs and my broken hand, and I started to laugh. And I started to think, well, actually, you know, this isn't too bad.
Two years to recover. I mean, alongside this episode, I'm also interviewing Nick English, who you know from Bremont, who you work with.
He had a few crashes.
You know, another adventure, as you say. I mean, he had a plane crash, which very sadly cost the life of his father. This was a defining moment of his life also. When you've had two big health scare and a crash like this, in terms of what that triggered you to do, if anything, I mean, obviously we've got the third series that kept brought you back together with you, and I mean, did it help you double down on things that matter, or what was the consequence, do you think?
Well, I think, like Nick, I mean, Nick broke 32 bones in his body or something like that. I mean, he was unbelievably lucky to stay alive, but he has a great positivity about life. And the thing was, I had this crash, and then 2 years later, when I was sort of just about walking again, I was in Africa. I take these people on motorcycle tours every year through Africa, from Cape Town to Victoria Falls on motorbikes, and I was doing that one, and then I had an even worse crash. Then I just remember waking up in hospital, and on that crash I broke my forearm quite badly, my left forearm, and then that snapped backwards and all the bones came out and the tendons all snapped, and that was quite bad. And then I broke my collarbone. So I had two plates in my forearm, two plates in my collarbone, and I broke my pelvis. And then I had a terrible head injury as well. And that's the one where when they found me, and my helmet had sort of half come off and was choking me, and I'd gone quite purple in the face, apparently. Anyway, and then I broke all the ribs on my left side and collapsed my lung and stuff, and brain, and then head injury, brain swell.
Do you ever get to a point where you just think, enough's enough? I mean, is it just something in the nature of the person that you just keep on going and putting yourself in those kind of, you know, sort of risky endeavors, I guess?
Well, I mean, for me, you know, a lot of the therapy to get back was to get back on a motorbike, and that was
face your fear.
Big focus for me, and I wanted to get back. But the other side of it as well, I think, you know, when I was in the first accident, when I was sitting there looking at these three limbs, and I was feeling very sorry for myself at that point, and you know, there were are moments when you're lying in bed and they're real, you know, especially at 2 or 3 in the morning, there's really dark, dark times when, you know, when everything, you're waking up, there's nothing around, it's dead silent, there's a lot of pain, and you think this is just never going to end. And those are the really hard bits. But I think there's a few different types of people. And I think some people end up with a trauma defining them. And often people can't really get past that trauma or let it go or live with it or whatever. And from meeting that guy who was next door to me, who was in much worse state, I don't think he'd walk again. And from that point on, I thought, you know, actually, I'm all right. You know, and I think that if you can leave it behind, and look forward, that's a much healthier way of looking at things. There's nothing you can do about the past. You know, I could have left the hotel a minute later and it would never have happened, or I could have done something else and it would never have. But the fact is that it did happen. There's nothing you can do about that. Well, so you just got to move forward.
Well, something you could do something about was you made Long Way Up. And yeah, a lot of people will, you know, if you read the reviews, a lot of people will say, look, this is different to the previous two. There's an environmental message. You know, there's a lot of the stuff that you expect in terms of the bonhomie and all of the great banter together. But there's also another message in here about the planet, about the future, yeah, the electric Harley Davidsons and so on. I mean, I'm just sort of wondering, I mean, do you think that having gone through a moment where your own survival is in question, that it puts into perspective other issues about what it's all about?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the whole electric of it all is, I think it's on its way. I think the planet has to change at some stage. I mean, if you just look at the you know, let's say look at the first lockdown, and you know, I was cycling around London and I'd never seen the sky so blue, and it smelled completely different. You could hear the birds and it was better. And I suddenly thought, God, this is what London could be like if we went as electric as possible. You know, in cities, it makes sense. You know, I'm not sitting there being an eco warrior, because I think there's a place for everything. You know, I love my petrol bikes. I love all that, but I love the electric bikes as well. And I can see the value in that. And I think when Ewan and I did, you know, Long Way Round, Long Way Down on motorbikes, those were challenges. If we went on petrol bikes and just went on petrol bikes again, you could easily do it and there'd be no real stress. And I think there's a lot of negativity around electric, I think, and that's partly because people are afraid of change. You know, if you look back at the times of horse and cart and a petrol car came along, people thought it was the devil or thought, oh, no, that will never catch on, or that you can't, it has no range, you can't go anywhere, you can't get petrol anywhere. You know, so everybody had the range anxiety syndrome then as they do now. And then people said it can't be done. So that was always interesting.
I noticed also though, Charlie, that you said it gave you a greater appreciation of where you were being on an
yeah.
Like something situationally different.
For sure. I mean, you know, the experience of riding the bike alone is extraordinary. I mean, because there's no engine, you know, you have to learn a different way of speed, because the pitch of the engine is a big part of your feeling of speed. But that's taken away. But quickly, you forget about the engine and the noise. And then you start to realize that you feel much more. And this is not trying to be too, you know, too earthy. You do feel much more connected to the ground that you're traveling on. You can feel the road better because there is that big vibration is not there. And then, you know, when you pull over on the side of the road, we pulled over in Argentina on the side of the road, and there was a whole herd of llamas and they were just standing there and just looking at us, because there was no engine noise. They weren't scared off and they got these beautiful big eyes with big eyelashes. They're very pretty looking. And then Claudio turned up and he had the petrol bike and he turned up and they all buggered off. So it definitely has a thing. And it was a great introduction as well, because you'd stop with people and you'd need charges. You need to get power from people. And you would stop and you would say, look, do you mind if we plug in? And they go, oh, no, what are you doing? You go, we're doing it this trip. And they want electric bikes. And they go, oh, wow. And then they said, what kind of bikes is it? And we said, well, they're Harley Davidsons. And then they start to laugh. Go, what, Harley Davidsons? You know, so it was
amazing to see them. I mean, because of course you expect them to be very different, because they're good looking bikes. I mean,
and they work.
But just a last question, if I may. I mean, Vanity Fair described Long Way Up as the perfect antidote to quarantine blues, mainly because they looked at it as sort of talked about this kind of like, you know, obviously the vibrant, you know, sort of journey, the adventure. And it got me thinking about, well, what does the post-lockdown adventure look like? I was going through your Twitter feed. You retweeted something. You said, feeling inspired to plan a little adventure. Screw that. When lockdown's over, I'm going on a big adventure. So my question, the last one to you is, what's next?
Oh, well, when I sign up with you, I'm going paddleboarding because it's such a beautiful day. But there's a few things coming up. I'm a big fan of cooking. And so there's this, I'm going to do this sort of adventure travel thing with cooking all around Britain and Ireland. So that's coming out quite soon. And that combines everything, combines motorcycles and travel and people and people who make
and a frying pan.
And a frying pan, and the people who do the most incredible things. And we talk about airplanes and travel and stuff, but it's interesting that I've got a great farmer friend of mine up in Scotland, and he said, look, if we really knuckle down, you know, Britain can easily self-sustain itself in beef and in vegetables and in all this stuff. So part of that, I'm going to go and have a look around and see these fabulous people who are doing amazing things.
And is there another long way on the way?
Well, I think, you know, when you do these big trips, when you get to the end of them, you're super excited to go home and see your family and friends and get back into the thing. But another part of you, if someone said, oh, look, I think we should go back the way you came, you go, okay. And so always towards the end of a big project or a big adventure, you know, we start talking about doing another one, which makes it easier to stop the one you're on. So we're talking about Long Way Down Under or Long Way Scandinavia, or, you know, I think there's another couple in this. I think maybe we started talking about Long Way Down Under. So, I mean, who knows?
Well, watch this space. Charlie Borman, the adventure continues. Thank you very much for joining me on Changemakers.
All right. Thank you very much, guys. Have a lovely one.
Changemakers is brought to you by the campaigns firm Seven Hills and presented by me, Michael Heyman. Pure Being is the name of our soundtrack, and it's written and performed by the brilliant BT Wolf. To find out more, head over to changemakers.works, and if you like what you hear, why not give us a rating?